Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart, welcoming you back for the last weekly market recap of the year. And we're very fortunate to be joined by Michael Leibowitz today, to great talent to round out, I don't know, great year, kind of a crazy year. But what do you think, Michael?
Great. I'm glad you're having me, and I'm happy to be the one that kind of rings the bell for the year.
Yeah. I mean, we've got that guy Lance Roberts here mostly, but I'm glad that we could upgrade to the top tier talent here in the final week.
There you go.
Yeah. And folks, Lance is off skiing, hopefully not breaking an arm or a leg or something worse. And we'll have him back on in the new year, although we'll keep having Michael on too whenever we can get him. All right. Well, Michael, look, as we wrap up here, there's sort of a lot of year-end discussions I'd like to have with you in today's conversation. Maybe we could just sort of start, though, which is there was a lot of debate over the past, you know, 5-6 weeks of whether there was going to be a Santa Claus rally this year or not. It doesn't seem that Santa showed up this year.
Nope. Santa got stuck in the chimney, I guess. the Santa rally is a function of kind of year-end window dressing. So what I mean by that is that at year ends, most times investors want to put on, stocks are up in most years. So investors, institutional investors, want to show their clients that they were fully participating. So what they will do is buy a lot of stocks towards year end. And it has the effect typically of pushing stocks higher. This year, as we know, was very different. Both stocks and bonds were lower for the year. So sometimes window dressing entails putting on the winners and selling the losers. And some of the bigger stocks this year were this year's losers. So companies like recently Apple, Tesla are down significantly. So when you talk about window dressing in this kind of year, it can have a negative effect. Now, keep in mind, volume is very light. Has been very light for the last couple of weeks. So it doesn't take much to move markets. And, you know, it's just one of those years. And given what we've seen all year, it's not surprising that Santa didn't show up this year.
All right. And I'm just curious, and I've been thinking about this a lot after having had Peter Atwater on the program recently, who really focuses on confidence. And for him, it's all about sentiment. Don't know if I'm reading too much into this Santa absence or not, but could the fact that we're not seeing too much buying materialize at the end of the year here be sort of a sign of shift in sentiment, that buyers are just becoming more and more gun shy after getting battered and bruised all year?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. So the AAII Association for, I don't know what the other A is, for individual investors, recently put out a study. And this is going to be the first time ever that all 52 weeks in a year had bearish or negative sentiment. The first time it's ever happened. And we obviously closed the year with pretty negative sentiment as well. So the question is, what does that mean? A lot of people like to say, well, that's a bullish sign. When there's too much pessimism, everyone's on the wrong side of the boat and you end up with bullish bull rallies. And you can certainly make the case that's happened in the past, though. However, when you also look at how those individual investors are positioned, they don't own nearly as many stocks. I mean, I take that back. They own, their holdings of stocks is roughly the same as what it was at the beginning of the year. So yeah, their sentiment is poor, but they're not really acting on that sentiment yet. They're still kind of bulled up if you look at their holdings, but if you ask them, they're bearish. And
yeah, that's sort of why I was asking. Yeah, that's what I was asking the question here is because I believe that's largely been the dynamic all year, that sentiment's getting more bearish when you talk to them, but their positioning has still been relatively, you know, long the market like they've always been.
Right.
Could we now here at the end of the year, because Santa rally didn't arrive, you know, could this beginning to show that they're starting to put their capital where their sentiment is?
Well said. I don't know. I don't put too much credence into the Santa rally last 2 weeks. I also don't put too much credence into what's going to happen over the next week or so, because some of that is just a reversal of what happened over the last 2 weeks. To me, this whole what happened through 2022 and what will happen in 2023 is a function of the Fed. The Fed has become the driver of sentiment. They've also become the liquidity for the market. And, you know, we can debate all day of how much the Fed really directly affects the markets. But I think there's no debate that the Fed indirectly has a huge effect on markets and on investor sentiment. So as we look ahead, what's going to change for the Fed? And that's what I kind of keep thinking about here. And the Fed is very clear. They want inflation down to 2%, not 3%, not 4%, but 2%. And that's still much higher, much lower than where it is right now. And even if inflation does start coming down, it'll still take a decent amount of time to get to their bogey. Now, one of the things that drives inflation is demand. And the Fed is very clear that they are trying to weaken demand, consumer demand, corporate demand. And to do that, they believe they have to weaken the labor force. So, you know, when you think about what the Fed's telling us, the Fed is telling us they want to raise rates probably another 0.75% in slower increment, in lower increments, 25 basis points at a time, which gets us to called 5 to 5.25% on Fed funds, and then leave it there. So if you look at the market's expectations, it thinks the Fed's going to get up to just about 5%, hold them there for a few months, and then come late summer, July, August, September, start lowering rates again. What's been known as the Fed pivot. So when we think about the year ahead, I think there's really three paths. And I was starting to write this out. I'll publish it maybe in an article next week. I kind of think about the markets as these three potential paths ahead. One is the Fed's path, where they raise rates, say another three times, and then just keep them flat for the year. The second one is kind of what the market's expecting, which is somewhat in line with the Fed, where they get them up to 5%, but then they start falling again. Right now, the market's pricing in almost 50 basis points or 0.5% of rate cuts in the second half of next year. And then there's the one that Lance and I keep talking about, the something breaks scenario, and which is grounded in history, that basically that higher interest rates are slowly but surely having a bigger effect on the economy and on the markets. And eventually something's going to break. We've seen things breaking already. The British pension funds, that's a function of liquidity drying up in the bond markets that drove those highly levered pension funds to basically get margin called, which just creates a circular problem. I think FTX is a function of liquidity. Liquidity dried up in crypto space. So it's like a liquidity creep. Liquidity is slowly being drained from the markets, and it's coming in from the most kind of extreme over-levered parts of the market, but it's just slowly working its way into the more popular.
Right. The less levered,
more popular instruments. And I think that creep is going to continue to happen as interest rates stay at these levels and even increase higher, as the lag effect from those interest rates. Remember, the Fed didn't hike interest rates till March. They started in March of last year. That means if you think there's a one-year lag effect between when they hike and when it's fully affecting the economy, we're not even going to get that first 25 basis points of hike felt in the market until March of 2023. Then we have, you know, a series of 475 basis point rate hikes and QT, which also drains liquidity. So I think the Fed has done a lot, but its effect, it still, most of it has yet to affect the markets and affect the economy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we start feeling. And that's why I think the something breaks scenario is most likely. It's also kind of the way it's always worked. Yields pop up, the Fed hikes rates, the economy goes into a recession, and yields come down quickly. We see that with yield curves. they've been an excellent predictor of recessions, and yield curves are now the most inverted they've been, depending on which one you're looking at, but the more popular ones are the most inverted they've been since in like 40 years. And when yield curve inverts, so the yield on the shorter term bonds is higher than the yield on longer term bonds, they uninvert very quickly. It's almost like a V-shaped pattern. They invert and then they uninvert. So you get a pattern like this that you can see them uninverting by 200-400 basis points in a year or two. And that's what keeps me up at night. It's how does the yield curve uninvert if the Fed is saying they're going to keep everything, you know, relatively stable? The market's kind of saying they're going to that they think everything's going to be hunky dory, that rates are basically going to stay up here. Maybe they'll come down a little bit, that earnings are going to rise another 8% next year. Everything's very, very Goldilocks-ish. But we know from history that yield curves don't uninvert in Goldilocks fashion, and they always uninvert. So, you know, what's different this time, I guess, is what bothers Lance and I, because if nothing's different, we have something will break this year or next year.
Okay. Great. You know, framework there. Love the three different pathways. Did a great job explaining what you're watching and what you're worried about. Rapid fire questions here for you. First off, going to push you here a little bit, just for entertainment value's sake. You've got the three paths. You said the something breaks you think is the most likely of the three. Mm-hmm. Give me percentages amongst the three different outcomes there.
I think outcomes A and B, the Fed or the market, they're kind of in the same ballpark. Maybe 25% that everything goes right, 75% that something breaks. Now, it doesn't by break, it doesn't have to be a 2008 breaking, but I think it does entail the Fed lowering rates quickly.
Right. It's something that forces the Fed to reverse policy.
Right. Right. And how stocks react depends on how much further stocks are down before that happens. But traditionally, when curves uninvert, stocks don't hit their lows in cycles until the curve is already back to positive territory. Earnings do not hit their lows, their maximum drawdowns, until the yield curve is back into positive territory. But stock market, I actually posted this on Twitter today. Stock markets do not bottom until we're already in a recession. So, you know, we're in a downward trend. You know, we can debate all day whether it's a bear market or not. Lance doesn't think we are, but everyone else, including myself, does. This downward trend or bear market, in theory, is not going to end until we're already in a recession. We just had a very strong quarter in the third quarter, and odds are we're going to get another 2-3% growth in the fourth quarter once the data comes out.
All right. Well, one question I have here, Michael, is a yield curve can uninvert in one of two ways. Short-term yields can come down, mm-hmm. or long-term yields can go up. Right? The long end of the curve can catch up to the short end. I believe you think it's going to be the former, because it sounds like you think what's more likely is something will break, the Fed will pivot policy and therefore start trying to cut rates. But I don't want to put words in your mouth. What do you think?
I think that's right. We could certainly be wrong, but I also think that if it is the latter, where longer rates rise and catch up to smaller rates and go above them, that will also break something. This economy is driven on debt, and you know we've already seen the housing market collapse isn't the right word, but traffic has completely dried up. Prices are going down because mortgage rates got, you know, 7% to 8%. Well, what happens when they get to 10% or 9%? And that's what and it's not just mortgages, it's auto loans, it's everything, corporate debt, credit card debt, you know, government debt. So it'll just further break the economy if yields rise further, which would then force once again, the Fed to lower rates. It would crush the economy, which will crush inflation, which will then bring longer term rates down. So, you know, exactly how the yield curve uninverts, I don't know. I know traditionally it uninverts because the Fed aggressively lowers rates and short-term rates fall much quicker than long-term rates. And you get this 200 to 400 basis points worth of uninversion in a year, year and a half.
Okay. So let's see. So looking at your probabilities, I want to sort of finish out the Fed discussion here, but then the thing I wanted to talk about with you was sort of big drivers for 2023. And obviously mm-hmm. Fed is probably at the top of that list, but there are a few right. others that could, you know, add either uncertainty or just sort of cross currents to the mix here. And also eventually want to talk about bonds again and everything we're talking about here that the Fed may or may not do or what happens with the yield curves. That's going to very directly affect the prices of bonds going Absolutely. Forward. So that's going to be really interesting. All right here. So, but basically, you know, most of the folks I've talked to on this program recently, not all of them, but most of them, the consensus is I'm going to sort of call the Zuloff outlook, which is continued weakness through Q1, kind of a lot of the same playbook that we've seen so far, you know, rates marching up, maybe even the dollar starting to strengthen again, stocks and bonds maybe trailing down until such point that there is something that forces the Fed to pivot here. Felix, like you guys, thinks it's more probable that the Fed's going to be forced to reverse course as opposed to be able to get to 5 and then hang out for the foreseeable future.
Right.
Also, by this time, as you said, we're going to be getting slammed into the effects of the previous rate hikes that have already been made, right? So the economy is going to be increasingly struggling. We are going to likely see an earnings recession in companies, which is going to, you know, put downward pressure on stock prices. You know, it's basically going to create a recession. And you know, many people are saying the Fed is making the recession worse than it would otherwise be by continuing to hike in the face of what we're all seeing here. I'm not guaranteeing this is all going to happen. I'm just saying this is what I sort of see when I look through the lens of guys like Felix and a lot of our other recent guests. And so they then think that Fed will pivot. There will be some assets that respond very quickly to the announcement of a pivot. Things like precious metals, dollar may start weakening really quickly. And also bonds, particularly U.S. treasuries, will likely start rallying pretty hard in anticipation of lower rates in the future. Stocks may take a lot longer to recover. For a couple reasons. One is the market tends to want to see some proof first of earnings beginning to recover to get stock prices up. And if you look at previous periods where the Fed has pivoted, you often see a lag of a couple of quarters usually before right. the stock market bottoms and then takes back up. So that's kind of looking through Felix's lens. And like I said, it's probably the consensus lens of folks I've had on this channel recently. I think that's relatively in the ballpark of what you guys are thinking as well. And of course, everyone's going to be looking closely and making audible calls as we get more data. But I'd like you to react to that just in general.
I think in general, you pretty much got it. I think what I find very funny is that everyone, all these stock investors in the media, you know, on Twitter, all over the place, want a pivot. They're begging for a pivot. The pivot is the last thing they want. The Fed's going to pivot when there's a problem. That's not, you know,
not
that's
bullish for stocks.
Yeah. It's not bullish. Longer run, it may be bullish, but initially it's pretty bearish for stocks. So you don't want a pivot. You actually want what kind of Wall Street is pricing in this pivot, but really slow, you know, 25 basis points a quarter, which has never happened, but let's pretend it does happen. You want just a gradual slowing of the economy, inflation coming down pretty quickly to 2%, and then the Fed just slowly backing off everything they've done for the last year. That's Goldilocks. That's I'm not saying it can happen, but it's never happened like that before.
It's not likely. Yeah.
Now, keep in mind, Adam, the last 3 years, nothing ever like this has happened on all sides of the, you know, all right. sides of the equation, you know. The pandemic itself was something that's new to us, right? And right. locking down economies, the Fed's reaction, the government's reaction, consumers, consumers' reaction. Let's go out. It's a pandemic. Let's go buy whatever we can buy. Let's put additions on our houses. Let's buy second homes. Let's buy sports cars. Let's just spend money. Right. And that's why, you know, as we're kind of coming to the other side of the whole thing, how's that going to normalize? This is all about normalizing, getting back to the trends that we were on before 2020. And I think the Goldilocks scenario is this normalization process that's very gradual and very slow. After, for the last 3 years, we've seen nothing but tremendous volatility in economics, in markets, in sentiment, in behavior, in politics, in you name it.
Right.
Just volatility.
All right. So I like this theme of normalization. And of course, that presumes that there's no other major grenades that get thrown into the mix here. Which there always are. But hopefully we get a little bit of a break. So two of the other potential 2023 drivers on my list here are sort of normalization factors. One is China reopening after a very prolonged period of lockdown. And while there are reasons to be pessimistic about the first half of next year that I just laid out there, that may be a counter trend to a certain extent there. How big of a factor do you think that could be of China, you know, basically unleashing a lot of pent up activity and both consumer power and productive power?
I think some of that can be potentially, yes, it will help growth. But again, let's listen to what the Fed's telling us. The Fed's telling us that they're not happy with economic growth. They're not happy because it keeps inflation bid. It keeps inflation up. So there's an inflationary component to China opening up. They will demand, their demand will pick up. Their supply has pretty much normalized. So the supply side of the equation, just because, you know, yes, there probably will be more Chinese workers getting back to work and producing things, and supply of goods will fully normalize. But the demand side is probably the bigger story there. And there's an inflationary component to that. So that's what makes this very different than anything we've witnessed pretty much in our careers, is that the Fed is fighting inflation. They're not fighting economic activity or economic growth. All we've ever seen since the early mid 1980s is the Fed trying to steer economic growth,
right?
Economic activity. Now their number one battle is against inflation, and anything that keeps inflation higher than where they'd like it to see, which again is 2%, means the Fed will do more to restrict growth. So if China reopens, and if China, let's just hypothetically say, adds a little bit of growth to our GDP, and it keeps inflation a little more higher than it would be, well, the Fed's going to raise rates a little bit more to try to counteract that whole effect. And yep, that's why I kind of struggle with the China thing. If this was 2018, 2019, I'd say that's a good thing. That's a positive. China will contribute more to growth than they have been. But I'm not sure we want growth. The Fed certainly doesn't want growth. And again, for me, the number one rule is follow the Fed. And right, you can like them, dislike them, not care about them. It doesn't matter. That's what's driving markets right now.
Right, right. And I guess where I go with this is, for those who are feeling particularly bearish about Q1, right, could this be a factor that says, you know, this actually could keep things more robust in Q1, if depending upon the speed and magnitude of China's opening up here. And yeah, that might require a heavier Fed policy response in Q2 or whatnot. I'm just trying to get a sense for, like,
is it
one of those factors where you shouldn't be so cocksure on whatever your sentiment is because this is a countercurrent?
Yeah, and part of the problem is, like, it's hard timing this stuff. And part of the problem is that when the activity in China will start happening in January and February, by the time data is released, it takes a good few months. We're not going to know about what happened or have data behind it till April, May, June. You know, same with the U.S. we're not going to fully understand what happened, you know, holiday Christmas season until February and March.
Right. And sorry to interrupt, but what's interesting about that is you're right. And let's say the inflationary, let's say there is an inflationary, you know, addition to the inflation story from the China opening, and we don't get that data until June. Well, in certain scenarios, the Fed may already be into its pivot by then, right? If something had broken beforehand, right? Which would be really interesting, right? The Fed's already committed to reversing policy. And then all of a sudden it says, oh my gosh, China's actually really putting the accelerator on inflation here. But so now we're supporting it too.
So the Fed, I think this is very important. The Fed knows they screwed up. I can't use the F word, so I'm just going to say screwed up because it's much worse than screwing up what the Fed did. The Fed, you can make a case that in 2020, the Fed did what they needed to do. And I'm fine with that. The economy was shut down. They had to help the government. Basically, it's almost like a wartime type of atmosphere. And again, we can debate that all day, but it is what it is. It's really later 2020 and 2021, where they just kept pumping the economy. They kept, you know, they kept doing QE to massive levels as inflation was starting to become problematic. And that whole time they're saying, don't worry, it's transitory. There's nothing to fear. And next thing you know, inflation's at the highest levels in 40 years. Consumers are getting crushed because wages aren't keeping up with inflation. And, you know, it's created a huge problem because not entirely, but in somewhat large part, because the Fed kept pumping the economic engine through all of 2021 and didn't recognize inflation. It's funny, if you go back and look where the Fed, so every quarter the Fed puts out their summary of economic projections, and they talk about GDP and unemployment, and they put out their estimate for Fed funds as well. If you go back and look, they all thought Fed funds would be 1% or less, right where we are now at the end of 2022. Well, they're 4.25% right now.
And headed higher.
They're headed higher. That tells me they grossly screwed up in what they were thinking, and they know it. And I think they really know it. And they also are desperately trying to prevent a repeat of the 1970s, where inflation kept coming back and coming back. So they want to not only squash inflation, but make sure it doesn't come back.
Right. Sorry to interrupt, but this is where I find kind of what 2023 hinges on, which is totally get what you've just said there, right? They want to just not just subdue inflation, they want to kill it, right?
Right.
But you're also saying, I think something's going to break that's going to force their hand here, right? So the massive existential question for 2023 and probably beyond is, can the Fed actually do what's needed to kill inflation, or is its hand going to be forced by other factors? I think most people I talk to seem to think it's going to be forced.
Yes, I think both. I think they can do what it takes, but what it takes is a lot of financial pain. So the question is, how much financial pain will they let rip through the system? And it's not unemployment going up 1 or 2% from where it is now. It's not even negative GDP if it's minus 1 or 2%. It's the stock market. It's a bank or banks having trouble. It's a foreign nation teetering on default. I think those are the things that keep the Fed up at night. And as long as the economy, look, we could be in a recession, but as long as it's not a deep recession, as long as unemployment's not going to 9%, I think the Fed is willing to accept that to make sure inflation comes down. If the unemployment rate's at 9%, inflation is going to be zero or negative. We're going to have deflation. So they will have accomplished their goal. If we're in a very deep recession, there will be no inflation. There's never been inflation after a recession, after a big recession. So it all kind of hinges on what is something breaking even mean? And it could mean some combination of all three of those things, a bad economy, high unemployment, and a bank failing, or a big company failing, or the stock market down another 40%. You know, and I guess, Adam, it's hard to try to figure out what combination of those events ultimately pushes the Fed to say, you know what, we've done enough. We're confident right. Inflation has been slayed.
Well, and also, even if their hand gets forced, right, and the Fed starts easing again, or at least cutting rates again, that doesn't mean that inflation is going to come roaring back, right? I mean, there's a lot of pent up impact that's still coming in the system from all the rate hikes that have been right. done. The global right. economy is slowing. We're going into recession. Other countries, you know, worse off than we. And so the actual just sort of economic deceleration impulse that's coming may still be so great that even if the Fed goes back to easing, it still brings, you know, inflation eventually back down to the 2%. Because remember, right. and we can debate whether we believe the numbers or not, but for many, many years, the Fed was keeping rates at, you know, near zero and doing QE, and inflation was tame, at least as measured right. by the CPI.
Right.
So a Fed pivot, again, and this is me sort of having to remind myself, doesn't necessarily mean inflation jumps right back up again.
Right. That's right. And if you think about the environment before the pandemic, deflation or disinflation, not really deflation, very low inflation was the theme, regardless of what the Fed did. And the reason is the theme is because there's so much debt in the system, and that debt acts a lot of it is unproductive. It doesn't create economic growth. It just sits there, and
it's an increasing drag on it because
that's what it is. It's a tax on the economy. And if you look at what we've done over the last 3 years, we've taxed the economy even more so. So when we get through this whole pandemic process, economic part of the pandemic process, there's a bigger tax on the economy in the future than there was before we went into their pandemic, because there's just that much more debt and unproductive debt in the system. Yeah. And so I think, unlike the 70s and early 80s, we are looking at a revisit of disinflation, deflation. And the Fed, you know, maybe not next year, maybe not in 24, but in 25, the Fed's going to be begging again for 2% inflation.
Right. Trying to get it up to 2% inflation.
Yeah. And the problem is we can't afford 4% inflation, because 4% bond yields break the economy.
Right. And to your point about looking back at the 70s and the 80s, the national debt back then, in the private debt as well, I mean, they were just tiny fractions of what they are right now.
That's right. And so the Fed had to raise rates so much more back then to have the same effect the Fed can have now by raising it 0.5% or 1%, because, like you said, the amount of debt was so much less back then.
Yeah, it's funny. And we've said this several times throughout 2023. But I think we probably need to bang this drum a little bit harder going into the new year, which is that, understandably, everybody has been focused on inflation, and they still are. But that the bigger bad in this story may very well be disinflation and outright deflation at some point here. That we, to your point about the Fed, might be begging to get some inflation back again, you know, in 2025. That we may, at some point going, you know, later half of 2023 into 2024, just saying, oh my God, we're stuck in this recession. You know, the forces of deflation are crushing us. Yeah, maybe we need some stimulus now.
Right. And, you know, you go back to every Fed speech for the last 5 years before the pandemic, and they all want more inflation. It's more. We want more. And that's what crippled them in 21. They got what they wanted, and they thought it was just temporary. And they're like, this is great. We got our inflation. It's a little more than we want, but this is great, isn't it? And it just kept sticking around. It wouldn't go away. And then, you know, as you kind of got closer to 2022, they were starting to like, maybe this isn't what we want.
Right. So, the whole be careful what you wish for.
Right,
And it's crazy. You know, we rant on this program a lot about how much we have to talk about the Fed, right? To your point, like we're all sick and tired of talking about them. We'd much rather talk about investing. Oh, what sectors look good? What companies within those sectors look well positioned? But for so long, it hasn't really mattered, because to your point, it's been Fed policy that really has driven the price action of the market. So sadly, we're still focused on that. And to your other point, like, yes, the Fed is what matters, but we look at the people running the Fed and they are eminently fallible. I mean, they have really made a lot of terrible predictions and a lot of terrible decisions. So it's really kind of soul crushing in a lot of ways to realize that the whole global financial systems and economy's future is in the hands of very small people who do not have a very good track record.
Right. Well, and the economy to come to their side a little, you know how I feel about them, but to come to their side, the economy is very dynamic. It's changing all the time. It's incredibly hard to put data to what's really going on, right? The whole idea that there's one inflation number is ludicrous. My inflation and your inflation are two different things. We spend our money different ways. We live in different places. We shop at different stores. It's everything about our lives. And it's true for the 350 million Americans. So to try to put a number on inflation, and even if you can put a number, how do you accurately measure the prices of all these goods and the whole shrinkflation? And, it's impossible. So, the fact that they say we want it to 2%, not 1.8, not 2.2, but 2%, is so ludicrous. And then you kind of work through it. You look at the unemployment numbers. It's a survey. They're not using actual data.
The data, yeah.
Retail sales doesn't account for inflation. I mean, the data is very flawed and very misleading. So when you have to run policy based on that, I think it'd be very difficult. And like I'm sure Peter Atwater talked about, there's the psychological effect to all this that you can't model. We're irrational human beings. We do things that don't make sense that you can't model. And right, if you want any evidence of that, look at the last 3 years. So, yes, the Fed is greatly at fault for 2021, but I think trying to think that they're going to get it right in 2023, or anyone for that matter, is going to just nail the timeline on what's going to happen and when, I think is ludicrous. And right. I think you talked about it earlier, audible. That's going to be the key for this year. We're going to be the quarterback and we're going to be audible and left and right as we see the defense changing on us. We may be bullish. We may be bearish. We may be uber bearish. Who knows what we're going to be? But my guess is whatever we think is going to happen next year, no matter what anyone thinks, it's going to come out very different.
Different. Yeah. And I'm really glad you made that point. And real quick, so I appreciate the point you're making about the Fed has a really almost impossible job to try to predict things with perfection. At the same time, you're making a pretty good, argument for the question of, well, should we even have a central authority being trying to control these things, or should we have a more market, driven solution? I don't want to get into that because it's a whole discussion of itself. And I see you nodding and smiling as I'm saying this. But I actually really agree, and I want to emphasize this point for listeners, which is we've had a number of people back on the channel recently. Zuloff again himself have said, look, going forward, active management is going to come back into the center of successful investing. It's just going to have to. That the passive approach that has been so easy and worked so well with all the intervention, that era is now over, right? And so... Right. That by itself is important, but we have such a, turbulent year coming up here with all the things that you and I have been discussing. And I've got one or two other factors to go through here too, is on the active side, we're going to have to be very nimble in reading what's happening and positioning, both in the short and long term. And so those audible calls are going to be really, really important. And again, that's one of the reasons why we have you and Lance on weekly here for that, Michael, is to give those audible calls as you see the data changing on the ground. So just for folks that watch this weekly market recap, probably talking my book a little bit here, but I think it's going to be even more important going into next year because of that audible factor.
Yeah, I think that 2022 in a way was easier. The Fed became transparent about what they were going to do. The market was in a reliable downtrend. But now we're getting to the point where the Fed is probably close to the terminal rate. And the question is, what is the reversal? What is the how does it normalize? How does it change? And I think that can be very hard to predict. It's never been easy. And you're still, we got the hangover of the pandemic that we're still dealing with. And it's not, again, there's a whole psychology. Our psychology has changed, our sentiment, our, you know, you see it with the way we work. Everyone works from home. I mean, it's just, everything is different. You know, it's the fourth turn. Have you ever read The Fourth Turning, Adam?
Yeah, and actually we just replayed a video that I recorded, interview I recorded with Neil Howe 2 days ago on this channel, because he's writing a new book based on that framework that's going to come out in a couple of months, and we'll have him on the channel then. But yeah, we literally just ran a Neil Howe interview on this program.
So it's an incredible book if you haven't read it. Neil Howe actually lives pretty close to me, so we haven't done it in a while, but we used to get coffee now and again. And I would pick his mind. He would pick my mind about markets. And he always seemed to deflect a lot of fourth turning questions about timing and what. Mm-hmm. And I think what he'll tell you is he doesn't know what will the fourth turning event be, what it is. Maybe it was a pandemic, maybe not. But we're going through this period of immense change. And I think when we look back on the 2020s, all of this will be obvious, but we're in the middle of it. And it's very foggy as to what will cause sentiment to shift so violently over the last couple of years and over the next, 4 or 5, what does he think, by like 2029, 2030, the turning will end?
To be honest, I'm waiting to have the interview with him to get the latest update on that. Right. But yeah, I think last time I talked to him, he sort of felt we were sort of like halfway through the turning, and they're about 20-year cycles, right? A turning is about 20 years long, each one.
Right. And the gist of his book is basically that we go through these generational periods, and they each last 80 years with 20-year increments. And when you get to the end, which is the fourth one, the fourth turning, there's always a big event: World War II, the Civil War, the Revolutionary War. And you can go back through like European history, and these same themes occur and recur. And his book does a great job of explaining why, and I'm not doing it justice.
That's right. But basically, just to interject, it's where the status quo basically fails and gets replaced by a new order. Yeah.
Correct. And he has his thoughts. I think his new book talks about what that new order will be, where we are in the turning, and you know, who knows what else is in there. But it's another one of those kind of it's not macroeconomics, it's just more sociology, I guess, on how humans think and how we not really evolve, but we go through these same kind of themes over and over again. One of the themes I remember was he talks about this hippie-ish generation in something like the 1820s. You know, we thought the only hippies were the 1960s.
Right.
Again, it's these same themes kind of come back and forth. Yes.
Yeah, they're cycles. They're historical cycles that happen, according to him, with some degree of predictability. Yeah.
Exactly. So, be ready to buy Audible. Active management, I think, will be key, not just for this last year or this coming year, but the next few years. And, you know, maybe we've seen the end of passive management. Maybe, and I think it's for the better. It's for a better capital allocation, which is better for the economy. But maybe we're getting back to active management.
Okay. Well, I will say that is the consensus of the folks that I've interviewed over the course of this whole year on Wealthion, which is that's one of the secular shifts in the investing world that's going on right now. All right, real quick, I've got a couple more drivers, and then there's a number of other questions I want to ask you before we wrap things up here. This has been a great discussion, by the way, Michael. We're literally still on the sub-bullets of my first bullet here. So it's a good sign of a meaty discussion. So Ukraine, I'm not a geopolitical analyst. My sense is that the world is increasingly hungry for some sort of resolution there, right? I'm not going to use the word necessarily a peace or a Russia withdrawal, but I think everybody is increasingly, and I'm sure politicians have been working on this a lot, you know, over recent months, trying to find some sort of peaceful resolution to the hostilities there. That will likely be a, positive development for the world, obviously, but probably for markets, it'll remove some uncertainty there. I guess, depending on the type of resolution, that'll really, have repercussions in terms of some of the constraints right now in global trade. Maybe we'll never trade directly with Russia again, who knows? But maybe, some of these embargoes and stuff like that might start being lifted in the wake of a negotiated settlement. So again, I just think that that's just another really big audible factor that we're going to have to analyze in real time when and if it happens next year.
And, it can go both ways, right? I think some kind of peace settlement, potentially where Russia gets a small part of the Ukraine, does happen. But what scares me is that, you read the media and Russia's getting it handed to them, that they're losing a battle. But what bothers me is that they have a massive air force and they really haven't used it. So what is stopping Russia from really just taking Ukraine? And, I always try to think of both sides of the coin. I think the peace side is the easier one and the more pleasant side to think about. Then you have the status quo where this just drags on for another year. It becomes kind of their Vietnam. They got bogged down in Afghanistan just like us. But then equally concerning, what if Russia says enough of this? We're tired of this Vietnam. We're just going to end this war. We're going to take what we want, what we think is ours. So, I think it's hard. I'm certainly no geopolitical expert. But again, keep your head on a swivel with Russia and China too. China keeps kind of poking at Taiwan. Who knows how if they're serious about it or if they would ever do anything about it. But the implications for that on global trade are massive. So, a lot of geopolitical stuff you try to predict, but it's usually unpredictable. So kind of in the back of your head what happens if it gets worse? What happens if it gets better? What happens if it's just kind of the same meandering for the next year? And take it as it comes.
All right. And it's so interesting because what kind of kicked us off in this whole discussion was your point about 2023 hopefully being a year of normalization from these big distortive events that have happened. We can see a path towards increased normalization on some of the things we just talked about, Ukraine, China, et cetera, but we can also see potential for increased deformation if these things go south.
Right.
So I like your comment there about keeping our heads on a swivel and just having to really be revisiting this stuff, frequently throughout the year. Yeah. All right, last point on kind of big drivers for 2023. I think this one is a lot more predictable than the other ones we've been talking about, but you tell me. But it does seem like we are going to be having, people use the term earnings recession, but at least we're going to see continued margin compression going into next year. And there's been a lot of talk about how earnings estimates for next year still haven't really been brought down to match the reality that we're seeing on the ground here these days.
Right.
So do you agree with that? Do you agree that that's probably one of the more higher probability developments we can bet on as investors?
I do. I think it's a combination of margin compression and just lower revenue.
Lower demand. Yeah.
Lower just demand.
Whole point about demand. Yeah.
Right. I mean, the Fed wants to crush demand.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you have consumers. If you look at what's happened to consumers, they've drawn down their savings to rates that are incredibly low, historically very low. And then they started increasing their credit card usage to very high levels. Both of those are unsustainable. You only have so much savings. You draw that down, you got no more savings.
You get to debt saturation. Yeah, you just
and you get to debt saturation. Right. And now add in higher interest rates for that debt. So one of my concerns is January, February, March, that we had one last hurrah in November, December. We bought everyone presents. We went out to dinner. We did all the things we always do during the holiday season, and that we're gonna completely pull back in January and February and March. And again, we won't know if that happened till April, May, June. But that has a potential to really slow earnings. push earnings lower. Wages are going up, which is going to put pressure on earnings. And it just, margins were already at record highs. It's hard to sustain those kind of right. margins in this kind of inflationary environment.
Yeah. And I'm sorry to interrupt. I can't remember who it is. I want to say it's a name like Jeremy Grantham, but I can't for certain attribute it to him. But there's a quote out there that says profit margins, like of all the data sets in finance, it's one of the most mean reverting data sets out there.
Correct. I think that is him. And they're very cyclical. You know, they're not sustainable because they come at the expense of the public. Yeah. That's really where it's coming from.
Okay. So for those that are, you know, again, from an investing standpoint, that's a bearish development, right? And so we would expect to see further further continuation of the bear market. I'm trying to remember, are we finishing in a bear market yet in 2022, or are we still like less than 20% on the S&P?
Well, you're asking me or Lance? Lance declares a bear market when we break the trend, the right. upward trend, and yeah. we're not there yet. We were down over 20%. We're probably right around 20% now, I'm guessing. Yeah. It's a bear market. It's a downward trend. I don't care what you call it. It's a downward trend. And, you know, there's a million different opinions on it, but it doesn't matter. The elevator's going down.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a question. I just put it on Twitter yesterday, just to mix things up at the end of the year. Three questions. One is, do you think we will make new lows in the S&P next year versus what we've seen here in 2022?
Yes.
Okay. This is where it gets a little uncomfortable for you. Put a number and a timing on it. And I'm not going to hold you to this, but it just a gut feel, right?
I think we could get down below 3,000, 2,800, okay. 2,600 even.
Okay. This and that's is where pretty it gets substantial from the 3,800 where we're at right now.
Correct. And I think that may be very late 2023 or even into 2024.
Oh, so you see this more as like just a grind down for 2023, more or less?
But a grind down like we've been grinding down. You know, there are going to be some nice rallies, some bad sell-offs. But I think at some point it starts to level off. You take out that volatility and it's just a grind that really starts hurting investors. And that forces, that changes the investors. Positioning. That's what finally gets the positioning to match their sentiment.
Okay. So my third question was going to be, you know, where do you think the S&P is going to close at the end of next year? But you kind of gave us your answer, which is you think it kind of grinds down. Thank you for being bold to do that. I'm not going to hold you to those numbers, but it helps.
Please don't. But again, you know, I may come on in June and tell you I was dead wrong. We're going to 4,500, 5,000 right. because X, Y, Z and A, B and C.
Yeah, that's why these Audible weekly check-ins are going to be so important next year. Okay, so but that's a very equities focused question. I'm presuming, and I've been wanting to get this discussion to bonds, so let's trundle over into bonds now. I presume your outlook for bonds is different, and I'll let you. I won't cede your answer. I'll just let you answer it any way you like there. But maybe in your answer. You know, kind of talking about mean reversion, we've just had the worst year maybe ever on record for U.S. Treasuries. Mm-hmm. it was certainly one of them. And Lance has said, you know, a number of times on this channel, like when that happens, when you look at the data set, in most cases, you see positive performance the year after. Of course, no guarantees and whatnot. But, you know, take that factor into consideration in your answer here on where you think bonds may head next year.
I think they're going lower. The question is how much, how far, and when.
And sorry, when you say they're going lower,
bond yields. Bond yields are going lower.
So bond prices up, yields down.
Yeah, but again, in a trend, bond yields may go higher. They may go a little bit higher than where they were a few months ago. But the trend is lower. And at the end of the day, it's a function of how much inflation is there and what kind of economic activity is driving inflation. I think we're going to be in a recession at some point next year. I think inflation will come down pretty sharply. So if interest rates are 4%, 4.5%, 5%, and inflation is back down to 2%, 3%, real yield, so the difference between yields and inflation, is very positive. That is a tax on the economy. Real yields have been flat to negative for the better part of the last 10 years.
Right.
As the Fed, you know, and that's to promote growth. So again, this is another tax on the economy that the economy can't handle, given that it's debt driven. So it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy that higher yields create lower yields. The question is when. Now, that's kind of the easy part of bonds. The harder part is the supply side. So, you know, we may get all of the economics, the Fed, inflation right, but if there's 10 zillion bonds coming to the market, it doesn't matter about any of that. It's what price does it take for people to absorb that demand?
Yeah.
So I think one thing that potentially helps on the supply side is that Congress is split. So the odds of massive fiscal spending are certainly reduced than if one house held sway over Congress and the executive branch. But the other part of the supply problem is the Fed. They are reducing their balance sheet. Effectively, what they're not selling bonds, but effectively those bonds are going back to the market. Right. They're maturing, but the Treasury has to reissue debt. So what matures gets reissued to the public away from the Fed. So that's an additional, you know, call it 95 billion of supply a month. And foreign nations are selling Treasury debt. Japan's been selling Treasury debt. They're our largest debt holder. China's been selling Treasury debt. They're our second largest debt holder. So you have the supply, the foreign supply too. So this is a more traditional supply demand question on bonds, is who will buy bonds? And I go back to the real yields. Once it's kind of shown that inflation will be back down, and I'm not saying rates have to go to 2%, but when investors are comfortable enough that the trend lower is intact, and maybe it'll be a couple more months, the opportunity to buy bonds at 4%, 3.5%, 4.5%, 5% will just be too great. And, you know, if we would have had a discussion 4 years ago, Adam, I'll take your money. I'm going to put it in. I'm going to guarantee you 4.5% for the next 5-10 years. You want it? You would have jumped on it. A lot
infinite,
of people.
Infinite demand for that back then. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, those trends back then are the same trends that are going through now. We just had these massive distortions because of the pandemic. So when we fully get out of this whole distortion phase, those trends exist. There's a reason that inflation was so low, that economic growth has been slowing down for 30 years. And the opportunity to own risk-free debt, or even risk debt, so credit, corporate bonds, good corporate names where you can earn an additional 0.5% or 1.5%, I think will just make a lot of sense, especially not just to me and you and other people listening, but to pension funds, endowment funds, massive institutions that will love the certainty of those kind of real yields.
Right. And there's a carrot and stick side to this that are both pro bonds, right? Which is, when, to your point, when the world wakes up and says, hey, you know what, yields are now, the trend in yields is now downwards. Mm-hmm. There's the carrot of, all right, well, let me lock that in now, right? Let me buy today and lock in these rates going forward before they go lower, right?
Right, right.
But if what is driving the trend moving downward is, you know, basically something that's forcing the Fed to pivot. That's the stick where everybody is saying, oh my God, you know, we've got some crisis going on in the world right now. I want some safety. Let me get in these risk-free instruments, right? Mm-hmm. So there's sort of both sides of the coin, you know, at least in those two situations I talked about, are telling you to buy these bonds.
Right, right. I like bonds, and I'm also don't need to look at them day by day, look at their price. I'm very comfortable that what I'm buying today will prove its value over the near term. near term, I don't mean a week or month, but over the next few years, I think I'll be very happy that I bought these bonds.
So just two things, maybe three things. One is
always three things.
Going back to Lance to give you something to react to. He and others I've talked to, but certainly Lance, you know, I will repeatedly check in with him on this, but he has said this is potentially the best bond buying environment, at least for U.S. Treasuries, that he's seen in his lifetime, just in terms of how the conditions are lining up here. I know you're not Lance. I know that Lance is can be big and bold sometimes in his statement. But how do you feel about the current, you know, opportunity set as you see it right now with bonds?
I don't know about our lifetimes, because last I checked, Lance was alive in the 80s when he could have bought a treasury bond for 18%. That would work its way down to 2%. So I don't think it's anywhere near the magnitude of what we saw 40 years ago. But again, it's real yield. How much purchasing power are you gaining or losing? And for the most part, bond investors have been losing purchasing power by buying bonds for the last 10, 20 years. This is the first time in that period where you can gain decent purchasing power. So if you buy a bond that earns 4%, inflation's 2%, you're actually earning money. You're earning the ability to buy more than you would have.
Power.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I think when you look at it on that scale, and if you know, let's just go back to those trends, you draw that 30 year graph of bond yields, and it's just going down. And there's a reason it's going down. It's going down with economic growth. It's going down with inflation. And again, the other side of this distortion, those trends are actually even more intact than they were before. There's more debt. There's less productive debt. There's, demographics have only gotten worse over the last few years. And so when you look at the deviation of yields from the trend line, and I think this is what Lance is looking at too, the deviation is about as great as we've seen it.
Seen it, yeah. And I think that's where Lance's enthusiasm is coming from, which is, if we get to the point where yields start coming down again, he sees potential, nothing's guaranteed, but he sees potential for the movement of those yields from a percentage basis to be pretty substantial over a short period of time, mm-hmm. which the longer you go out, on the yield curve, the appreciation potential can be really big. So I think that's what he was looking at is, hey, you're getting paid finally something decent to be in these things. They are risk-free. And they have this nice sort of call option potential that could get exercised or affected in a relatively short period of time if things develop the way that we think they could.
Right. So I've got a question. Quite a few times I've gotten this question. I think this will help your listeners. The question is, well, how much price appreciation should I expect from a bond if yields fall? And it's actually a very simple math equation. It's called bond duration. And bond duration is essentially its maturity. So if you're looking at a 10-year bond, the duration is approximately 10 years. It's not quite 10 years, but it's close enough to 10 years. So what that duration means is that the price will move 10% for every 1% change in yields. So if you think yields are going to drop 1%, a 10-year bond should increase by 10% in price. A 30-year bond should increase by almost 30% in price. A 2-year bond will increase 2% in price. So that helps you respect what can happen with prices. Now, keep in mind, if yields go up 1%, that 10-year bond will fall 10%. Right. So it's a function of reward and risk. Try to be careful not to think of this as Lance and Mike must be right that yields are going to come down. So let's just focus on that reward and let's buy the 100-year bond that'll move 100%. And there is a 100-year bond. I think it's Austria has a 100-year bond.
I think Argentina had one.
I'm sure they had one. but be comfortable on both sides of that coin if you are buying bonds. And again, Audible, That I think that's going to be the theme in the bond market too, that we have to be ready to audible. Lance and I are both very confident on where bond yields are going, but you know, we're human beings and there's a lot of things that can change. What if inflation doesn't come down? What if the Fed changes their inflation target? You know, there are things that can happen, and we're fully aware of both sides of the coin, the risk and the reward.
All right. And I just want to remind folks, you know, Michael, clearly an expert on bonds. If you haven't watched the free webinar that Michael did for the Wealthion audience, we did that, what, about 2.5 months ago or so, Michael?
And this was like Thanksgiving.
This was like a, you know, hour and a half long, like an hour presentation with probably almost another hour worth of Q&A from the audience. So Michael really goes through, you know, the bond math, just making it really intuitive and easily digestible by the average investor. If you haven't watched that yet, folks, definitely spend some time early this year getting your brain around it. Just go to wealthion.com/bonds and you can watch it there for free. Also, Michael, you and Lance have put together some bond sleeves that people can invest in to take advantage of some of the upside that we were talking about here that you guys think, you know, probably lays ahead for bonds. And I don't want to get into all the details of that because Lance has already done that several times on this program. But one of the nice things about it is, if somebody ends up working with you guys, you know, they get access to those sleeves. But if somebody has an existing financial advisor or self-manages the majority of their portfolio, but they want to park, you know, some percentage of that in these sleeves that you guys are putting together, that's totally possible. Folks, I think there's a $100,000 minimum on that. So this isn't for everybody. But folks, if you want to learn more about that, just fill out the short form at wealthion.com/fixed income. And the team there at RIA, which is where Michael and Lance work, will get back to you and tell you everything you might want to know about those things. All right, Michael. So look, let's see here real quick. Let me ask you, as we are in the last, we were in the last trading day of the year, which market hours closed while we've been talking here. What trades, if any, did you guys make this week?
Zero.
Okay. And Lance kind of prepped us for that last week, but yeah.
Yeah. I don't think we did any trade. It may have been 2 or 3 weeks since we've done a trade. I can't think of the last trade we did. We were very comfortable. So the market, you know, if you look at the stock market, it kept hitting 3 or 4 times this year. It hit this upper resistance line. We got up to near that upper resistance line, and we had sold before that, reducing some of our equity risk. And we were comfortable with where we were positioned. We thought the market would trade lower. A lot of our technical indicators were kind of telling us that the market's likely to trade lower. So we had been well positioned early, mid-December, somewhere in there, and just kind of letting it go from here. We want to add to our bonds in the portfolios, but we've been waiting for a sell-off. We've gotten that sell-off the last week or two. Some of it is probably, again, year-end, quarter-end window dressing. So we'll see how we come out of, you know, we'll see what happens the next week or two as some of that window dressing reverses, as everyone gets bullish because we got a new grand year ahead of us. And we'll start making moves as we always do. But right now we're very comfortable with where we're positioned.
Okay. And I'm just going to ask, because I noticed right before we hopped on here, TLT, which is a U.S. Treasury bond fund on the longer end of the curve, has dropped below 100 again. And so, as you said, you're looking forward to buying more bonds. Is that an important development? Is that a price at which it catches your attention, or?
It's coming to a technical level where we think it should find some support. Again, you know, the last few days are very liquid. Prices just get pushed all over the place. If you want an example, look at Tesla.
Right.
Tesla stock. What we want to make sure of is that this is part of a bottoming process. So you kind of want to, you know, when it was coming down, it was doing these jags down and then hit a lower low and what they call a lower low. So the price is at a lower level than the last time it kind of troughed, and a lower high. So it doesn't, you know, it's almost like a staircase sort of.
Yep.
We want to see the opposite occurring on the upside. So we had a nice run. I think it hit 92, 93 up to 108 or something like that on TLT.
Exactly.
It's dropped back to 100 or so, 99, whatever it's at today. We'd like to see it pause out, you know, stop somewhere around here, a couple points from here, and then kind of take another, take out a new higher high. That would be a great sign for us that the bottom was put in bond prices or high in yields, you know, a couple months ago. So we're looking for technical affirmation to support our fundamental bias.
All right, cool. And that stair step, looking for the reversal from lower highs and lower lows to starting to see higher lows,
higher
and
highs.
Hopefully higher highs. Right. That's a great indicator that we can monitor on the, you know, future weekly updates that we do here with you guys. All right, well, real quick, like I said, this was the last trading day of the year. I just got some of my last tax loss harvesting sales in. I was sharing on Twitter, you know, I sold a lot of my my precious metals mining company losers, which was a painful process to hit those that sell button. And I'm sure I've just guaranteed a tremendous rally in those stocks over the next month as I wait out the 30-day watch.
Hold on one sec. Let me buy some.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great indicator there, negative indicator. But yeah, so I'm now going to sort of wait out the wash sale period and probably buy a number of them back. Hopefully not at too much higher prices. And I'll get some exposure to the sector in the interim in some other instrument that I haven't right. owned, so I can still have exposure, but not trigger the wash sale right. requirements. But anyways, Lance and I have been, you know, telling people leading up to the end of the year here to do. That's one of the things that they should do or consider doing leading up to the end of the year. So now we need to start the discussion of, okay, so what things should we be doing at the start of the year? One thing I want to remind folks who watched my videos on iBonds, which is if you actually use the gifting strategy I talked about, and you gifted some bonds that are now sitting in a gift box, you know, for whoever you gifted them to, or if anybody gifted them to you, you can now take those out of the gift box starting January. Just remember that you can't buy any iBonds for 2023 if you take delivery out of the gift box, but if you're following the strategy that I laid out earlier, that's totally fine. That's what you're expecting to do. But just know that as soon as January 1st hits, I don't know exactly if the Treasury has a, you know, holiday itself the first couple of days of January or not. But anyways, in those early days of January, you can now receive $10,000, up to $10,000 in iBonds out of your gift box there. Michael, is there anything else that you would, you know, kind of tell folks to be thinking about at the beginning of the investing year here?
Keep an eye on the Fed. You listen to the Fed. Don't listen to what the market tells you. They thought they heard the Fed say. Just listen to them. Powell has been incredibly blunt, very
inconsistent.
And consistent. If you do nothing else, just listen to what he has to say. Don't read the articles that summarize what he said. Just listen to him. He's telling you what's happening. He has been very honest about what's happened for the last 6 to 9 months about what he wants. He told us that financial stability, that financial the means of the, I'm drawing a blank on the word I'm looking for, but basically that stocks, bonds, and asset prices in general are what kind of help create inflation. He's telling you he wants stock prices down. He in my mind, there's never been a Fed president that's been that blunt, chairman that's been that blunt about what he wants. So just continue to listen. He's telling you he wants a higher unemployment rate. If he, you know, he can't come out and say, I want more people fired, but he is telling you things that the press really doesn't want to latch onto. So
yeah. And sorry to interrupt, but he has been saying that. I've been saying since the summer, yeah. That the translation of his words are, I am declaring war on the jobs market.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So do yourself a favor. And just when he speaks, listen to the speech, read the transcript. You know, that after that, go ahead and read the Wall Street Journal or Yahoo Finance or Twitter, or whoever's in what we think about it, what Adam thinks about it. But he's being incredibly honest, and take advantage of that, because that's not usually the case. And my theme last year was follow the Fed. My theme this year is follow the Fed. The Fed is an incredibly important player for asset prices, stocks, bonds, real estate, you name it. So we're going to just continue to follow the Fed here. But nothing, there's nothing that's jumping out at me that we're going to do. You know, we're going to come in on January 3rd or whatever that first trading day is and say, we got to buy, we got to sell. There's just, you know, I'd be shocked if we make a trade on day one or two.
Okay.
I could be wrong now.
I'm just asking you to paint with a broad brush here. Let's say some other people did what I did, which is they sold for tax loss harvesting, and they're now sitting on some cash. Mm-hmm. Would you have any general advice to them? Either like, hey, this is a good time to just sort of sit in cash because we want to see how things play out, or is it I'd start a dollar cost averaging program, or you know, given today's conditions, is there any particular thing you would say about someone who's all of a sudden sitting on some new cash?
So to help guide us, we use a lot of technical indicators. And we have our broad macro themes and follow the Fed, and that kind of points to a downward market. But think about it as a downward market in a broad channel. And within that channel, it's cycling, hitting the top, hitting the bottom, back and forth. And you can draw it out and you can see it. So, and there's a bunch of indicators that tell us if it's oversold, overbought. And we're kind of sitting there at fair value now. We're not near the top. We're not near the bottom of that downward channel. Some of our indicators are saying that we're starting to become oversold. Some are saying that we're, you know, again, we're at fair value. So, you know, on the margin, you know, it's probably if you own no stocks, probably a good time to dip your toe in the water a little bit. If you sold all your bonds, I would make sure I have some position in bonds because they could rally pretty strongly come the new year, potentially. Now, we're not going to buy bonds on January 3rd because we already have a decent position of bonds. But if we had no position in bonds, we would probably be on January 3rd buying bonds. But we are already comfortable. We're already comfortable with the position we have. And look, if we're wrong and bonds just shoot out of the gate in price, that's fine because we already have a big position.
You have exposure. Yeah, I got it.
But you want some exposure to it, is kind of where I'm going.
Yeah. And I'd put some words in your mouth. Feel free to correct them. But on the equity side of things, I guess I'd hear you say, don't be in a massive rush to redeploy all of that because of the downward channel.
And that's right. And that's what we're doing. When a new client comes on board with cash, we're very, very slow with the equity side of the investments.
Okay. And so you're, I think, leaping to a good recommendation there, which is, you know, on this channel, I always recommend that the vast majority of people watching, unless they are highly experienced managing their own money, work with a professional financial advisor, especially given the type of tumultuous year ahead that it sounds like, you know, you and I both think are coming. And so rather than just try to figure it all out on your own, leverage the expertise of a good financial advisor.
Right.
All right. Well, look, in wrapping up here, we don't have a ton of time for it, unfortunately, just because we had such a great conversation already. But Lance and I tend to end these recaps with what we like to call rants. They're not always a rant. Sometimes we're actually really, you know, shining a spotlight on something we think is really good. But right before we hopped on here, I noticed that you had just recently published a really interesting article called Capital Neglect is Killing Capitalism. And this kind of continues the theme that Lance and I have touched upon a lot recently. So I wanted to give you a couple minutes here, Michael, just to sort of summarize for people whatever key points you'd like them to take away from this article.
Yeah, so that's been my soapbox for the last 5, 6, 7 years, and probably even longer than that. And I kind of write versions of this article maybe once a year because I think it's such an important topic. And basically, all it is that a country has its capital, its resources, and its labor. And the wealth of the nation is essentially on how productive or how efficient you can use the resources and labor. And there's many, many things that drive that efficiency or what's called productivity. And there are books written on this, and there are books written on just various components that drive productivity. the purpose of this article is kind of talk about the Fed's role in driving productivity. And one of the keys to capitalism is the cost of money, interest rates. And when the market doesn't set interest rates, when they're hampered by the Fed, both upward or downward, you know, mainly downward, as we've seen for the last, you know, 20 years, they were lower than they would have been in a free market, it affects the allocation of capital. And when rates are too low, it creates basically misallocated capital. Capital that tends to go towards speculative purposes and not towards investment.
Right. Malinvestment.
Malinvestment. And to kind of think about it at an extreme level, malinvestment is buying a boat. You know, it's fun, it's great, it's nice to have, but it's not going to make you any money. Investment is doing work on the house so that you can sell it and ultimately make more money where you can pay off the debt. The boat's not going to pay off any of the debt that you took to buy the boat. Doing work on the house will help pay off that debt and maybe even make you money. So if the economy was productive, if productivity growth was growing, we could see high levels of debt, but the economy growing faster than the debt. And we've seen the opposite. We've seen debt growing much faster than the economy. And that tells you that the debt, that's why I keep saying, you know, I've sprinkled it a couple of times, unproductive debt. That's what unproductive debt is. And that's why it's a tax. When you buy the boat, you're stuck making those payments. And that's money that can't go towards something else. When you do the work on the house, and this may not be a great example, you can rent it for more, pay off your debt, and have extra money to buy other stuff. So it's essentially a rant, and it's why capitalism, we're still in capitalism. I'm not saying we're a socialist country or any of that, but we're not making the most out of our capital, out of our resources and labor. And the more you get out of it, the more wealthier all your citizens are. So it's a tool to help the poor, even more so than the rich. I mean, the poor in the United States are much wealthier than the poor in almost all other nations. And that's because we are the most efficient use of capitalism. We're far from what it could be, and I think could be a lot better, but the more you promote capitalism, the more you're helping the poor, you're helping wealth inequality. You're just getting the most out of the economic system. And again, the Fed is just one small part of capitalism. There's government, there's demographics, there's behavioral issues. There's a million other things that drive that productivity number. But I decided, like I always do, to rant on the Fed.
Yeah, well, and it's important, right? Because when, as you said, when the Fed distorts the price of money, then distortions in, you know, the prudent allocation of capital occur, right? We get bad policy leads to bad investment decisions, or bad allocation of our resource decisions. So that's there. I sort of see them as like the headwaters, but like you said, there's a ton of other factors that go in there. But of course, you know, when you get to things like inequality, right? Fed policy, and certainly we've seen this over the past couple of decades, you know, is a huge accelerant of that when the Fed gets as fully interventionist as it's been, right?
Exactly.
Because when the Fed pulls a lever for, you know, stimulus or whatnot, it rewards. The rewards of that go to a much smaller group of people instantly, and basically the masses get held in the bag. Or in a lot of cases, you know, when we get like the inflation that we've seen, the price inflation that we've seen, they get destroyed cost of living, and they're not getting any of the benefits of the jump in financial assets because they don't own any.
That's right. Those that can speculate do well when the Fed's being accommodative, and those that can speculate are not that big a percentage of the population.
Right. They're not. And I like to throw this stat out a lot. I don't like to throw it out. I just throw it out a lot because it's true, which is that roughly 10% of the population or households owns 90% of the financial wealth in this country. Right. It's a very small amount. And within that 10%, it's incredibly distorted, too. You know, it's the top 0.1% that owns like the vast majority of it all. And you get a lot of issues, and I won't rat hole into this because I've talked about them on this program recently, but like, we just had an interview with Nicholas Eberstadt, who is a researcher who's for years has been chronicling basically like the just giving up of millions and millions of otherwise prime working age Americans who are just giving up on paid work because they've just become so demoralized by the system. And so, and that's a subset within the now over 100 million U.S. adults 16 years old or older who are not considered in the labor force, right? So we have roughly one third of the people 16 and over who aren't even, they're not even playing the game. When we hear about the unemployment rate, they're not even factored into that calculation, right? Right. So when you talk about sort of, when you look at this from sort of a national standpoint of, are we putting our resources to their best and highest use? We have a massive amount of our resources that are just lying fallow right now.
That's right.
Yeah. It's and sad. So when it what's sad and when the reasons for that is because they are losing faith so badly in the system that they would just prefer to give up, right? Like giving up is not a path to a rich and fulfilled life, right? They're essentially giving up the dream, the American dream, right? Mm-hmm. But they've gotten to the point where that is preferable than engaging in the current system itself. And that really bodes very poorly for the national prospects.
And it also has a much broader effect than just that one person. You know, again, the more productive, more efficient you can use your resources, labor being a key resource, the wealthier everyone can be. So right. it's not just the one kid,
everybody.
Right. It's not that one 28-year-old living in his parents' basement. He's, you know, it's not driving his parents crazy. It's really affecting everyone.
Yeah. And you and I, and then we'll wrap up here with some, you know, less depressing topics, but, you've got kids. I've got kids. Got a daughter about to graduate college next year, home for the holidays. And, you know, you just sort of hear stories, you talk to their friends and whatnot. And fortunately, you know, in my kids' cases, you know, they're doing okay, but there's a lot of stress. I think every generation has had when you have to transition from being a student to, you know, being fully in the workforce and having to be 100% independent for all your needs and whatnot. But there is a real malaise in this society, or I'll call it a real anxiety, that I think is higher than it's been, certainly that I remember when I graduated, but where they just really feel like the system is stacked against them. It doesn't feel so much of like, oh, you know, I don't know if I have what it takes to succeed in this system and become really successful. It's more, I don't trust that if I just, you know, break my back trying to, you know, climb the ladder, that it's going to work for me anymore. There definitely seems to be a sense that the promise of the system is broken for a lot of these people.
Yeah, I think that's right. I get that impression from, I have a kid that graduated college a year ago. I get that impression from him. And I've been talking to some of his friends that have been coming around, and some of them, you know, have good jobs. Some are, you know, just kicking it around. But I get that same feeling that they just don't really know what their place in society is. Maybe we all went through that at that age, but I feel like, you know, by late summer when I graduated, I had a full-time job. I was wearing a suit every day. I was going to an office. I had the opportunity to kiss butt and move up the ladder and to work hard and to show everyone I was working hard. You know, these kids, I just don't get that same sense that that opportunity to do that is even there. So, you know, and that just creates problems for society.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm right there with you. You know, I used to have the anxiety at that age that there was a brass ring out there, but maybe I didn't have enough in me to grab it.
Right.
Now I think that they don't think there's a brass ring out there. Right. And that's the issue. And look, there's all sorts of other cultural things. And, you know, these younger generations, they've got some issues that they have to overcome themselves. But to your point, and this is my larger point, which is it's not good for society when they begin to kind of just give up like this. And I think Lance and I have talked a bit about this, and it's where people kind of begin to give up on capitalism, right? Which, you know, I pull that famous quote, it's a terrible system, but what is it? It's the worst system out there, except that it's better than all the rest, or something like that.
The worst of the best.
Yeah.
Or the best of the worst, I mean.
Best of the worst, yeah. And we've Lance and I have talked, you know, that we don't really have true capitalism anymore. And the concern here is throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? Which is, instead of fixing capitalism and bring it back to where it should be, we just give up on it, or we migrate right now. And we're definitely seeing this in the younger generations, where the siren song of democratic socialism, you know, is appealing to them in ways I understand, which is like, look, all right, I'm probably going to get screwed under any system, so I may as well vote for the guy who's promising me free stuff along the way.
Right. And just real quick, another shout out to Neil Howe. In his book, The Fourth Turning, he talks about that, how the younger generations are going to want more involvement by the government, more, you know, essentially more socialism.
They want more centralized control. Yeah.
So this, you know, it may seem odd, but this has been predictable. He called this 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, and that is why this fourth turning framework really is so interesting. And folks, if you haven't familiarized yourself with it yet, go watch that interview with Neil Howe. In fact, I'll put a link to it right here. It'd be a great video to watch after this one. All right. Well, Michael, look, this has been yet another wonderful discussion with you. We need to send Lance off to the slopes more often to have you back on the channel in 2023. Really do looking forward to having you back on for you know, the audibles that you and I have talked about. Hopefully we'll maybe do a few more deep dives on some key investing topics that the audience says they're really interested in. But I want to thank you for a great discussion. I want to wish you and all the guys there at Real Investment Advisors a really happy new year. We've been incredibly pleased with this relationship that we started with you guys right at the beginning of 2022. So
perfect timing.
Yeah, first week of 2022, Lance and I did the first one of these recaps. So this is our 52nd one, and I think they've gone really well. But I want to thank you, and again, the whole team there, for, you know, coming on board the whole Wealthion train and being such great contributors to it.
And thank you for having us. And, you know, I want to wish you, your family, and all the listeners a very happy, healthy new year.
Great. Thanks. And actually, to my question, folks, about, you know, what are things, some things people could do at the beginning of 2023. If you do not currently have a good financial advisor who takes into account all of the macro issues that Michael and I talked about here, I cannot emphasize enough, you know, my recommendation that you seek one out and that you work under their tutelage. If you've got a good one or know of a good one, great, stick with them, work with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion by one who does, perhaps even Michael and Lance and their team there at RIA, well, then go talk to one of the ones that Wealthion endorses. These are free consultations. They don't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these guys. They're just public services that these guys offer to help people, again, make more prudent decisions for the type of turbulent future they see ahead. So to set up one of those consultations only takes you a couple seconds. Just go to Wealthion.com. And if you enjoy these weekly market recaps and are looking forward to seeing a lot more of them in 2023, please do us a favor and support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Michael, want to thank you so much once again. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching, and have a great New Year's.